This is Seattle's Morning News. In for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. And we are beginning to learn what a Biden administration will mean for America's foreign policy in the coming years. The president-elect announced several top positions on his national security team, including Secretary of State. And joining us now to discuss is Pamela Falk, CBS Foreign Affairs Analyst. Good morning, Pamela.
Good morning, Aaron. Yes, it's very exciting. Today at 1 p.m. Eastern time, the president-elect is scheduled to introduce some of these cabinet picks in Wilmington, but we do know who they are already, and it's an interesting team as Secretary of State Anthony Blinken, who worked for Vice President Biden, both in the Senate staff and is in the vice president's staff. So what's interesting about the Secretary of State appointment is that he'll know how to get things done across the aisle in terms of funding, and he has been around the horn on foreign policy for years. On Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, who came in as a migrant into the United States, now will be dealing with migration. Avril Haines, who is the new Director of National Intelligence, first woman in that job. Jake Sullivan is the National Security Advisor. I don't think I have to say much about John Kerry, as former senator, former presidential candidate, as the climate envoy who negotiated the Paris Climate Agreement, which the U.S. is now first out of and then will go back into. And finally, Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield, who for me, based at the United Nations, is going to be a very interesting appointment. And they elevated her to cabinet rank, which it not always is. And so she's not the first African American female ambassador to the United Nations, but she is very focused on the diversity of the State Department, because she served since Ronald Reagan in the Foreign Service all around the world as ambassador to Liberia and as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs. And then 5 days after President Trump was in office, she was fired, as were many career professionals. And so she went on to do a lot of advising for Madeleine Albright's group and the former Secretary of State and other things, but she's back. And so there's a certain amount of "we're back" hearing at the State Department these days.
Yeah, it's certainly an experienced and diverse crew of people. Let's run down a few of these individual positions,
yes,
starting with Secretary of State. So Tony Blinken, we know he served during the Obama administration, Deputy Secretary of State, National Security Advisor. The department looks a lot different right now, though, considering the last 4 years and some turmoil
right
within that department. What is the most urgent foreign policy or national security challenge to this incoming administration, do you think?
Well, the first things they're going to do, and I think we can call them urgent, is get back in the climate agreement. Climate was a very important but not urgent. Until this past year, people are realizing that all these severe storms, the wildfires that you've seen, that everyone has seen, West Coast, particularly in the United States, Washington in particular, California in particular, all of that are being exacerbated by global warming. And so the idea is day one, the president has agreed to go back into the Paris Climate Accord and show leadership in that role. So that's one urgent issue. The coronavirus is the most urgent, and that involves getting back into some international agreements in addition to the domestic issues of vaccine distribution and everything along those lines, and making sure the U.S. has its own priorities straight. But getting back into the World Health Organization, which has tons of Americans at the helm running it, and for many years was very involved. They've made mistakes, but the Biden administration has acknowledged that, but it still means no one's safe until everyone's safe. And the idea here is to get other countries in the world, poorer countries, to be able to fight the virus as well, and to help in a Europe-wide, Asia-wide, North America-wide plan to distribute the vaccine around the world, the vaccines around the world. And so those are two. Then, of course, there's some of the more urgent crises like the Iran nuclear deal and Iran's nuclear weapons.
I'm glad you brought up the Middle East, because I think it is important that we mention the fact that Tony Blinken is Jewish. He's the stepson of a Holocaust survivor. We know that the Trump administration made some or helped broker some key peace agreements between Israel and Middle Eastern countries. Where does Blinken stand on issues in the Middle East, and specifically as they relate to Israel?
Everyone's been somewhat supportive. I mean, Democrats, Republicans, they hadn't foreseen this, so he hasn't spoken out too much on the specific Gulf agreements called the Abraham Accords, which brought in Bahrain, Oman, and Sudan into the relations with Israel. But, of course, the Trump administration just visited Saudi Arabia, and so I think that's going to be slightly different for different reasons. But the general sense of moving forward on a Middle East peace plan is something that Blinken has spoken out very, very actively on, and that is that the talks have to get going. And so that was something that the Obama administration pressed, but it's really fallen apart with, I mean, it's fallen apart. The President Trump peace plan didn't take off, and so they went to this other route, which was negotiate with Gulf Arab states in order to at least have Israel allies in the region. The bottom line is, Aaron, that the Biden administration is very focused on being aware of Israel's national security interests and being very protective of Israel while trying to get something going, because it's only getting worse. I mean, the poverty in the region is increasing, COVID in the region is increasing, and they're linked. And so it's sort of an accident waiting to happen, so to speak, in terms of foreign policy. And so they're going to try to get back to talks with the Palestinians and Israel and try to keep that going at the UN.
All right. Pamela Falk, CBS Foreign Affairs Analyst, thank you so much for the time.
Absolutely. Good talking to you, Aaron.
They have served their country, and now a Seattle area woman is making sure her fellow veterans get the help they need to get out of the cold. Kiowa Radio's Heather Bosch has our Charity of the Month.
When she started her nonprofit for veterans, Monique Brown, who deployed a couple of times with the Army overseas, knew she wanted to call it FOB Hope.
A FOB is the forward operating base that we stayed on, and it was all sustaining. And we got our mission there. We got our resupply there. We ate there.
She wanted her group to be that place of help and hope in Western Washington for vets who are homeless.
So I bought a van, and I got the logo on it, right? And I loaded up with sleeping bags, tents, socks, toiletries, snacks, and I just go out. Sometimes I have to get out of the van and walk it. I have fallen in the mud a few times.
But she and her volunteers are on a mission.
We're in the bushes. We're on the side of the freeway. We're in the places where the hardest to reach are.
And there are many in need.
There are 1,300 folks on a by-name list, veterans on a by-name list that we are trying to find, that we are trying to house. And the number is a bit smaller in Pierce County, but still the same issue.
When she finds those vets, she offers warm sleeping bags and other supplies to help them survive and earn their trust.
I know you're probably aware, but a lot of homeless people in general have lost trust in systems, and homeless veterans even more have lost trust in the VA and the other systems that say they're going to do something for them, and then it doesn't work out. So we are trying to rebuild that trust and get them off the street.
Off the street, her ultimate goal, her passion, motivated by a homeless vet she once knew who died of hypothermia.
So I just felt like, not on my watch. I'm going to do whatever I can to stop this from happening.
She says her vision is that no veteran will die cold and alone because they had no place to call home.
For me, saving one is a success.
This is Seattle's Morning News, sitting in for Dave Ross today and to the rest of the week. I'm Aaron Granillo. Thanks for tuning in. Well, after months of public battles, the resignation of a police chief and ongoing protests only adding to the pressure to defund Seattle police. Yes, after all of that, the city council has approved its 2021 budget, and the mayor plans to sign it. Ever Radio's Hannah Scott has the highlights.
Car tabs, safe injection sites, tiny home villages, and a Green New Deal. Those are just a few of the highlights of the new $6.5 billion budget approved by the council, including a new $20 car tab fee. Seattle drivers already pay $80 in city-specific car tab fees on top of the larger state and ST3 chunk of those bills. 60 of that, which is used for bus service, is set to expire at the end of the year. So in the end, this is actually lowering those bills, according to Council President Lorena Gonzalez.
Folks, through the end of the year, will be paying $80 in their vehicle license fee, and starting in 2021, that will be reduced to a total of $40. So this is not an increase.
Now, assuming the mayor gives her blessing, the new fee kicks in by July. The issue that still has to be worked out, though, where the money from the fee will be spent. Bridge repairs and maintenance, or investments that benefit cyclists, walkers, and transit users. While most council members pitched it as a way to help pay for bridge maintenance, in the end, they opted to have a stakeholder engagement process first, with unions, transit advocates, and others, before deciding how to spend the money later in the spring. The new fee, expected to bring in about $3.6 million next year and close to double that the following years, those later years will bring in more than the roughly $6.5 million the city currently spends on bridge maintenance, but far short of the $34 million that the city auditor recently said Seattle should be spending on that. Councilmember Herbold had concerned
that the council is handing the decision of whether we should provide funding necessary to partially implement auditor recommendations to a stakeholder group who might decide that the funds should be used for other purposes.
As did Councilmember Peterson.
Disappointed that the initial proposal on the dedication of these resources for bridge maintenance didn't go through. I will be voting in favor again today at the full council. But remain committed that if not this funding resource at the end of the stakeholder process, that this council continue to look for ways to find additional resources to meet the maintenance funding goals outlined in the recent audit for bridge maintenance, that this still be considered a potential source as we go through the community stakeholder process.
Other highlights include $132,000 for a new Green New Deal program advisor position, $140,000 for a climate policy advisor, $800,000 to convert homes from gas or oil heating to electric. On homelessness, a lot of investment, including $7 million for tiny home villages, 63 new street sinks across the city, nearly $300,000 to expand encampment trash cleanup, and more money for contracted case and outreach workers to help the homeless, along with the greater responsibility they'll now have with what we knew as the navigation team being over. The council also finally acted to some degree on safe injection sites, officially known as community health engagement locations, or CHELs, where those addicted to drugs can use under supervision. The council authorized shifting the more than $1 million it's had sitting in a pot for the sites for several years now over to public health. Some think that that will now lead to actually creating these under a revised proposal that would use the funds for existing sites where similar activities are already happening, such as low-barrier shelters. Of course, the big-ticket item for just about everybody who spoke during public comment yesterday.
To defund SPD by at least 50%. So defunding SPD. Defund SPD by 50%.
After a lot of back and forth and a last-minute amendment from Council Budget Chair Teresa Mosqueda that used revised attrition projections, the council agreed to strip another $2 million from SPD to ensure it could not rehire officers that leave. While it was questionable math for Lisa Herbold.
Seems a little cute to me, to be honest. Feels like it is an attempt to respond to the call for no new net officers, and it confuses the situation, I think.
And came up short for others. It ultimately passed, and Councilmember Deborah Juarez put her elder hat on to drive this point home.
Defund the police by 50% was a slogan, and it was an empty and misleading slogan. It caused damage, it caused pain, it caused trauma, it caused anger. But I understand the aspirational, emotional feeling of why some of my colleagues felt the need to do that, and I've done that before. And so I'm saying moving forward, can we start using the words about how we change, not how we fight? Can we start using the language that we see each other, that it isn't about calling out people, about saving face? Can we start to see the humanity in each other, in our city, in our country, and start healing?
Sky Radio's Hannah Scott.
You ready for the Daily Dose?
Let's do it.
Okay. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. As we head into Thanksgiving week, many of us are shopping and getting ready to stuff ourselves with comfort food. But not everyone has that comfort right now, especially during the pandemic. A lot of Americans out of work and suffering without enough food. In Atlanta, though, 5,000 families will not be going hungry this holiday, thanks to media mogul and philanthropist Tyler Perry. The actor and producer hosted a food giveaway at his movie studios on Sunday. The drive-up event gave groceries and gift cards to the first 5,000 families that showed up. This isn't the first time he's done something like this. Earlier this year, Perry picked up the tab for all the groceries bought during the senior shopping hour at 73 stores in Atlanta and New Orleans. At first, shoppers didn't know who was footing the bill.
And she said, "So your groceries are free." I still really wouldn't believe her. And I kind of was dumbfounded. And she said, an Atlanta angel is giving you your groceries.
News of this Atlanta angel spread online. Everyone started thinking it was probably Perry because he's known for being generous. He had just left a $21,000 tip for somebody at a restaurant in the area. So once it was confirmed to be him, he spoke to CBS. He said he hoped it would inspire others to think of ways they could help their neighbors.
You know, you may not be able to pay for 73 grocery stores, but maybe you can buy groceries for one person. Maybe you can buy groceries for a neighbor.
Perry says he remembers what it's like to be hungry because he himself was battling homelessness around 20 years ago. And now he's a billionaire, known for his over-the-top characters, but also over-the-top kindness.
Good on you, Tyler Perry.
Yeah.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, it is G. Scotts. Good morning, G.
Hey, good morning, A.G. Aaron Granillo. How you doing?
I am doing well. So good to talk with you. A Rams win last night, though, was not so good to watch. They beat the Bucks last night. They're now tied with the Hawks for first place in the NFC West, but the future looks good. Well, yeah. We're looking at here. Three of the next four, I'm looking at the schedule, so three of the next four games that the Hawks have are against the NFC East, just a terrible division, and they also got the Jets on deck.
Yeah, they're terrible. those teams are terrible. However, here's the problem.
Okay.
The problem is those teams, those coaches, yeah, they get paid to coach, and the players, they get paid to play. And when you start looking at the Eagles, that's going to be Monday night, traveling out there, I think this is going to be a tough game because here is a Carson Wentz, who's their quarterback, who the national media is absolutely just talking bad and reckless about this man, saying how he should have never gotten paid, saying that he should have never gotten the contract. So I don't, you know how somebody starts questioning you and your job performance. Well, when you might show up the next day for work, you might actually do a little bit better. That's what the Seahawks are dealing with the Eagles. In the case of the Giants and the Jets, oh, they're terrible. They're bad.
Those should be easy wins. Though that's what makes me nervous, though, because the Seahawks mm-hmm. perform best when they're up against the wall. Mm-hmm. I don't think they're going to go into this thinking, though, it'll be an easy win, right? They've got a different mindset thanks to the coach.
Well, absolutely. Thanks to the coach, and then also thanks to some of the leaders on that team, right? I mean, Russell Wilson, he knows this. He's been in situations before where the Seahawks have come home and lost that game at the end of the season against a terrible Arizona Cardinals team back when they were terrible. They've been through this before. But again, I want to just go back to these terrible teams that are going to play against. Now, we all can agree that they're terrible, but those teams have football players, right? They all have agents, and they're saying, okay, we're playing against the Seahawks. So when we play against the Seahawks, I got to put something good on film. So I am going to have to really play well because I want to try to get a contract next year. Yeah, our team is not that good, but this is about me. So what happens is you guys get a bunch of players that really get up to play against this good Seahawks team. So even though on paper it looks a certain way, it's going to be still a tough road. And as far as the Rams, they're 7-3. Mm-hmm. This NFC West division is a really good division. It's my opinion the best division in football. And I think the Rams are probably one of the best teams in football if they had a better quarterback. They have a quarterback in Jared Goff that's very inconsistent. But if he does just play okay, then the Rams play really good football. But hey, it's all right. Still bet on number 3 in the Seahawks.
Yeah, absolutely.
The NFC West. Sorry, Colleen.
Go ahead.
I was going to go off topic, but you have another football question.
I do. I like the X's and O's sometimes. Sorry about that, Colleen. so the
I
NFC
like pie.
We all, though. We decided pumpkin pie was the winner yesterday.
Oh, see, that's what I was going to ask you. We had a pie war yesterday.
Let's just talk about pumpkin pie then.
I mean, here's the thing. Look, I know I'm going to lose that battle. I mean, pumpkin pie is a staple in America. It just is. However, I'm a sweet potato pie guy. Why? Because that's just what I grew up on. And now, if I was someone who grew up on pumpkin pie, I would probably be talking about.
Have you ever had sweet potato pie, Aaron?
No.
I never have either. And then Dave brings up grasshopper pie, which I've never heard of.
AG,
Sully likes turtle pie because it's from his childhood. But
I thought I brought some sweet potato pies in. You didn't get any. I know Michael Simeone got some, and all the My Northwest crew, they got some. I didn't know if I blessed you with some.
When all this COVID nonsense ends, G, I expect you to bring a sweet potato pie back into work, and I will try some of yours.
But I just want to go back to the Seahawks and just say this. And this is more of a plea to the Seahawks. Hey, dear Seahawks, we really, considering we ain't having no Thanksgiving, our holidays are impacted. You have no idea how much we hang on to every single win. So when you win, it is like double during this time right now. So we need you to continue to be great. You're 7-3. Get ready to win this game Monday night in Philadelphia.
No doubt. G. Scott, listen to him 9 to noon today on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G.
Thanks, guys.
Listening to Seattle's Morning News, sitting in for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo, and Tuesday mornings we go live to our nation's capital and Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter David Ferenthal at the Washington Post. So, David, we saw President Trump tweet last night. He is recommending the federal government kind of get moving on a formal transition. Does this mean the campaign's legal fights are over and we can move ahead?
Well, we can move ahead. I mean, I think that's been clear, especially the last couple of days. I just saw that Pennsylvania certified its results. So this is over. It's been over 12 different times, but it's especially over now. Whether Trump gives it up, I mean, he has not given up his legal fights. In Wisconsin right now, they've got a bunch of poor county employees in a couple different counties stuck in a big room for 12 hours a day recounting ballots because Trump asked for a recount. So there are things still continuing. But, you know, this effort, which had no chance in the beginning of subverting the election, now has even less than no chance.
I think the sort of the general consensus is this is all a lot of bluster, right, and a little bit for show. So what is the president's end game here? I mean, is he setting himself up for another run in 2024, a future in media? What's the end game here?
Well, I think like most things with Donald Trump, I'm not sure you can assume that he really has thought about a long-term strategy here. He really often just acts, you know, in the moment. But I do think he would like, from our reporting, he would like to maintain a strong hand in Republican politics to sort of keep control over the party and maybe to set himself up as the main, you know, contender, the presumptive nominee for 2024. I don't know if he'll be successful in doing that. But right now, you know, as you've seen the last few weeks, he's got the whole Republican Party under his thumb, even when he's trying to steal an election that he obviously lost. Most of them wouldn't speak up against him. He also would like to make some money, and I think those two things are intertwined. Keeping control of the Republican Party probably gives him a chance to continue making money off his campaign and the RNC. So I think he'd like to do both those things, but is he executing a strategy that will let him do those things? I'm not sure.
All right, let's look to the future of President-elect Biden's incoming administration. It's diverse, it's experienced. What signal is the incoming administration sending to our allies and enemies across around the world?
I think it's three things. First, that there will be a continuity with the Obama administration. Anthony Blinken, the Secretary of State nominee, was a Deputy Secretary of State under the Obama administration. John Kerry, obviously the climate envoy, was the Secretary of State. Second, that there will be a rejoining of alliances, or you know, a re-strengthening of alliances, like the NATO alliance, like the Paris Agreement for greenhouse gases. And the third will be that it's going to be kind of boring, which honestly, I think a lot of people will welcome, that there's not going to be a need to check in on what drama is happening in Washington every day. The Biden calculation is that people will like that, that they can just go about their lives and not have to constantly check Twitter to see what's happening.
It may be boring, but I mean, they have some big ticket items they want to address, not the least of which is, you know, immigration reform. I mean, how are they going to accomplish these things?
Well, I think we'll know more after the Georgia runoffs in the Senate. I mean, if the Democrats have a Senate majority, even a narrow one, there's a lot more things they can do. If they can't, there'll be mostly actions through executive actions. And Biden will end up fighting with the Republican Senate a lot. But I do think that you will see them focus on climate change, on the pandemic especially, and on immigration. I think probably in something like that order. I don't think you'll see something like Obamacare, where there'll be a huge legislative effort to write a big, long bill. It'll take a year and make a lot of enemies. They're going to go for things that can move a little faster and can provide results right away that people can see. And that was a lesson they learned from the Obama administration.
So, you know, here in Washington State, we were keeping close watch on the climate czar position, actually, because our governor, Jay Inslee, was rumored to, you know, either be in the running or want that position. Now that we have John Kerry in that position, we know that Inslee will not be in that role. Is there any word, though, that our governor is in the running for any other cabinet positions?
Well, obviously, Governor Inslee's climate proposals from his presidential run had a huge impact on Biden. I think, you know, Inslee isn't credited enough with how much he shaped Biden's thinking on that. So it would not surprise me for Inslee to Governor Inslee to have some sort of role in the Biden administration. I think that the offer to Kerry was about Paris. You know, Kerry signed the Paris Agreement, and then it was torn away, or Donald Trump tried to tear it away. So by making Kerry his guy, Biden is saying, look, we're getting back to this agreement we already signed. We're going to ignore Donald Trump and pretend like we never stepped out of it. You know, whether Kerry stays in that role forever, whether there's a role for Inslee down the line, I don't know.
One of the knocks on the incoming administration is that, well, for lack of a better term, it's just kind of old, right? I mean, President-elect Biden, he just turned 78. We have John Kerry, who's in his mid-70s, Janet Yellen in her 70s. Where is the youth with the incoming administration?
That's something I've been thinking about as well. Joe Biden talked about himself and during the campaign as kind of a bridge figure, a transitional figure. He, you know, he was going to move the Democratic Party from the old guard to something new. And so I'll be interested in watching the next set of cabinet positions to see if people like Pete Buttigieg, Amy Klobuchar, you know, these sort of rising people in their 30s and 40s and 50s get those kind of positions to show us, okay, this is where the Democratic Party is going. Because obviously between Biden and Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer in the Senate, like the Democratic leadership is quite old. And if they're going to be the party of young people, they need to put some youngish people in power somewhere.
All right. That is David Ferenthal joining us live from The Washington Post. Thank you for the time.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.